thank you so much for coming, Connie. We've been playing a lot of Apiary the last week. Jamie sent a copy to us, and I have to tell you, you made my life a little bit hard, because I was like pretty much done with deciding what was my favorite game of the year. And then Apiary came around, and it's gotten everything out of whack.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'm glad you've been enjoying the game, and thanks so much for having me as well. I'm really, really happy to be chatting about, you know, Apiary and board games and everything else.
Me too. I mean, you know, I just started a podcast because I like talking about the things I like, and I never shut up, and my friends get tired. So I'm like, I guess I'll have to impose it on someone else.
I totally understand. I've kind of been there, so I can relate.
You know, I'm gonna ask you some questions. It may sound creepy because I know some things about you, but it's just because I've been stalking you online, hearing every interview.
I appreciate it, and it's also good to get to answer some slightly different questions too. So I really appreciate it. This is actually much more interesting for me. So thank you.
Yeah, and I watched just so I didn't repeat that many questions. The first one is, I know you're a lawyer, like that's your day job. Is there any overlap in the skills you use in your day job and then in your job as a game designer, something you think that uses the same skills?
Yeah, absolutely. There is actually, and I think a few different respects. And one of them is just sort of an attention to detail. I mean, that's what I do in my day job. And especially with how we use language and words, it's really critical in board games and in the law to get everything right and to very precisely say what you mean and mean what you say. Another piece of it too is just kind of analytical skills. I mean, one of the things that they always say that they teach you in law school is they don't really teach you the law. They teach you how to think. And so really kind of problem solving, you know, figuring out problems and solutions and things like that is 100% applicable to both my day job and also my, you know, side gig as a game designer. Sometimes it's a little bit tough though, because you problem solve all day at work and then you come home and then you do it, you know, all evening as well. But yeah, so there's definitely some overlap there.
Yeah, I guess it's like board games use a lot of logic, and I think law also kind of does the same thing. Oh yeah. Okay.
100%. I will say there's a lot more math in game design. So something that I've had to, you know, get a lot better at and sort of brush up my skills. You know, I haven't done much math since early in undergrad. And I'm realizing how much math there is in a lot of game design.
Yeah. Like balancing everything. And I guess there's a lot of math involved in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think there's a few, I think Reiner Genizia is a mathematician, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. Yep. Yes. I think his training, I believe I read that he has a PhD in some kind of mathematical field. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you described game designing as a side gig. Would you like to, like, at some point, of course, become a full-time game designer? Or is your plan for it always to be a side gig / hobby?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. So, I mean, I think, you know, in a perfect world, I would love it to be a full-time job. I think, unfortunately, the reality is that it's awfully hard to make that work as a designer. I mean, and that's why so many designers go into publishing, which is something that I have less of an interest in than the strict game design. So I think right now I'm kind of keeping my options open. I do enjoy my day job, so I'm relatively content to stay there. But I think there's sort of a piece of it too. And one is just kind of strictly, you know, how do you make enough money to live on game design? I think that's difficult. And then I think the stability of income is difficult as well, because, you know, you might have a game and you might get some good royalties, but then that's not necessarily going to continue on. And then you also don't get the same kind of benefits, you know, health insurance, retirement, and all of that you would get with kind of a normal day job. So I think it's kind of a difficult question. So I know that was sort of a dodge. That wasn't a great answer, but as I said, it's a difficult question. And I do, by the way, apologize. I have two cats who are very eager to be around right now. So you might see them kind of in and out of the screen, and you might hear them a little bit.
They're more than welcome. What are their names?
We have Poppy and we have Pepper.
Poppy and Pepper.
Yes, we're really leaning into the alliteration.
Okay. Do they look different because their names sound similar?
Yeah, well, they're both gray too, which makes things a little bit difficult, but they're pretty distinct looking, and we got them at different times. I mean, we got them about 5 years apart.
So. Okay. Yeah, that makes it easier. The next question is, I know sometimes that changes through the years or 1 week to another, but what are some of your favorite games? And also tell us when you don't enjoy, maybe.
Yeah, sure. So a couple of favorite games. I know one of the ones I've been saying a lot is Voyages of Marco Polo, and that's one that I just kind of hold up as an example of sort of everything that I want to be as a designer, because it's such a simple rule set. You have these absolutely game-breaking abilities, and then the replay value on that is just through the roof. I also want to shout out Frosthaven and Gloomhaven. You know, basically, I've played through the entire campaign of Gloomhaven. We're probably a third of the way through Frosthaven and continue to enjoy that. And then just to throw another kind of genre into the mix, I'll throw out a shout out to The Resistance Avalon, which is maybe the game that I've actually played the most in my life. So it's a social deduction game, but it has quite a bit of actual factual information that you're working off of. So unlike, you know, a mafia game or something like that, you're not just sort of throwing around accusations. I mean, you are doing that too, but you also have, you know, logic to base it off of. In terms of games that I don't like, I don't want to be too blunt in calling out games, but I will flag a couple of things that I don't tend to enjoy in games. And one of those things is really defined strategic lines. So when you take the first move of the game, you're locked in throughout the rest of the game, or you have a game where the player in the first seat always does X and the player in the second seat always does Y. Those tend to be things that I like a little bit less. So, you know, something like a Zulkin or a Puerto Rico are games that I respect and I think they're excellent, but I don't particularly enjoy. The other one that I'll sort of throw out there too is it, for me, I like either games where it's head-to-head combat. So something like Blood Bowl I've played a lot of, and I absolutely love Blood Bowl. But if it's a multiplayer game, I have a really hard time with kind of games that have you attack other players when that's not the focus of the game. So something like, you know, Mission Red Planet, where everyone is attacking everyone the whole game, that's the game I really enjoy. But something like a Lords of Waterdeep, where you're drawing mandatory quests and you're hitting one person with them, are things that I don't tend to enjoy quite so much. Although I will say I've probably played Lords of Waterdeep, you know, 50 times gaming career.
Okay. I really like social deduction games as well. I enjoy Werewolf a lot, but I think Avalon, like, because you're not just guessing, it makes it like a different kind of thing.
Yep. Well, and I think they just present really good stories. I mean, more so than some of the Euros. And I mean, I always say how much I love Euro games, and those are really kind of my primary love in games. But I can also remember very specific games of Avalon from a decade ago, you know, maybe not quite that long ago. I can't remember when the game came out, but, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, certainly, in a way that I think Euro games rarely have those experiences that stick out to quite that extent, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and there's a lot of social part in deduction games, and Euros sometimes lack that. Not every time, but, you know, like, you end up laughing a lot more when you're playing like a social deduction game and you get caught or you catch someone. Yeah, it has a lot more interaction, definitely.
Yep. Absolutely.
And yeah, I mean, I understand that it's not, I didn't ask you like which games you think are bad. It's just like a matter of enjoyment. I tend to not enjoy Ameritrash games, like thematic war games.
Yeah.
Those are hard for me. I kind of like Risk, but sometimes it triggers me because it's like, oh, it's so much luck and I lose because of the dice. And, you know,
I do think there's a real trade-off to be had, and everyone's preferences are going to be at a slightly different spot on this. But, you know, for me, if it's a really short game, you know, I'm okay with sort of infinite luck. But if it's something that takes a long time to learn and takes a long time to play, you know, you don't want that game to be 3 hours in and you roll double ones or something like that, and then you're out of the game. And I know that I'm saying that, and I just described Blood Bowl, which I just mentioned is an absolutely wonderful game. But maybe that's the exception that makes the rule.
That makes sense. Like, the extent also has a lot of, like, matters a lot in those cases. Have you played Spots?
You know, I have not. You know, the funny thing, I was actually just at a board game store today, and I was inches away from buying it, actually, with the idea of playing it with my parents over Christmas, but actually ended up picking up a couple of different games instead. But Spots is definitely on my short list of games to play.
Yeah, it's very luck based, but it's super short, so it doesn't bother me. I hadn't thought of it about like length having an influence on that.
Well, and you're putting Spots on dogs, right? So
yeah, it
just feels like that's just a winning concept.
Yeah, it's super cute. You're not like trying to eradicate your friends from the table, but you're like just building dogs.
Yes.
So moving on, and this kind of ties in a little bit, and I know it, mechanics you don't enjoy already, but what are some of your favorite mechanics as a player? And do you have any mechanics that you'd like to design a game around? I'm guessing you like worker placement.
I like worker placement a lot. It's probably my favorite. My favorite mechanism is probably dice placement. I really, really like the idea of having strengths associated with your workers. I think dice placement games can have a lot of really interesting kind of pre-luck elements too, where you roll your dice and then you figure out what to do with them. Bora Bora, I think, is a really excellent example of that, because you roll your dice and your high numbers give you really strong actions, but you're always required to place a lower number dice on the space. So if you roll nothing but high numbers, you can get really locked out of the game. And so I think some of these games that have, where you want to have lots of different numbers, but then the numbers are impactful for your decisions, is just such a wonderful decision space. One thing that I'd like to design a game around, and this is going to be kind of a very game designer-y answer, is that actually one of the games I've been kind of working on my own in the background, it's not making a lot of progress right now, is actually a roll and move game. And I've been describing it as a your roll and move, like Euro, you know, like a Euro game. Because I think it's a genre that is obviously much, much maligned, you know, as a very, you know, luck-based mechanism. But I think there's a lot of really fun things you can do with it, as long as you make sure that A, you have other things to do with your dice. So if you're rolling your dice, you know, the game that I'm working on now, every time you roll your dice, you have a suite of five different actions that you can do with them, one of which is moving. And the second thing is that you obviously want to make sure that higher numbers aren't just better. And so the game that I'm working on is also it's three interlocking rondelles. And so based on the number that you roll, you can choose different pathways to go around the board. And your goal isn't necessarily to make it to the end more or less quickly. Your goal is to basically land on certain spots, which allow you to do certain things. So that's something that I'm kind of working on in the background. I think there's a lot of, like Steffenfeld's Merlin, for instance, is a really good example of a roll and move that's very, very strategic. So that's something that I'd really like to work on at some point.
Yeah, roll and moves have like a bad reputation, I think, mainly because of Monopoly, I think. And
Well, I think everyone has I think an awful lot of us had bad experiences playing Monopoly as kids. I mean, we might have had good experiences with it as well, but there's all that, what was that game where you just, you know, you rolled and you had a bad experience with it.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a lot that you can do with that mechanism, more so than what people experienced when they were kids.
Yeah, and I think that idea of like giving you options, even if you roll a bad number, if you have bad luck, because there's people who just have bad luck, and in like just punishing them just doesn't feel fair. And it's great that you have like options. That sounds really appealing. And the rondelles are just pretty.
Yeah, rondelles are great. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It seems like everyone loves rondelles, but I'm sort of in that camp as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to resist a rondel. Have you played, and this one doesn't relate to rondelles, but have you played the White Castle?
I have, yeah. I just got to play it. I've only played it once, but I finally got to play it at PAX Unplugged a couple of weeks ago. And I really liked the dice mechanism of how they were sort of on the bridges and then they would slide to the sides, which would give you different things. And I thought that interactive element was really, really cool.
Yeah, that one combines like dice placement and worker placement. And I liked it, but then again, I had a hard time because I had like 9 actions in the whole game. So I was like, oh my God, what do I do? What do I do? It was really rough.
Yeah, that one's obviously very, very tight. And I think it would take obviously a lot of plays to really fully optimize, because it's like you sort of get 3 turns in and you're like, oh, I've done this totally wrong. And it's a third of the game and there's not really enough time to recover.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you can't switch strategies in the middle of the game, I think, or it would be hard.
It seemed like that would be hard, but that's one that I'd like to try a couple more times, just because I found the system really intriguing. I'm very interested in playing it again.
Yeah, I also want to play it again. I want to see if I enjoy it better and follow up playthroughs. We know you started playing very big like classics, like Catan and Carcassonne. So did I. I started playing Carcassonne and Catan. You also played Power Grid. But how did you make the transition from like board gamer to game designer?
Absolutely. I kind of fell into it, to be perfectly honest. So after law school, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I didn't know a lot of folks. And so I started joining a bunch of meetup groups just to try to build sort of a social network. And the ones that ended up sticking and the ones that I ended up enjoying the most were board game groups. And so I ended up developing a lot of friends, friend groups from some of these different board game groups and, really, really having a lot of fun with it. And so that kind of became an increasingly big part of my social network in my life. But I actually wasn't ever going to design a game myself until actually my husband, David, had an idea, wanted to design a game. I offered to help. I was like, sure, I'll help. I can help prototype components. That was a very short-lived effort. It didn't last very long. We learned that we don't really design games very well together. But it really gave me the design bug. And all of a sudden, it kind of opened my eyes that I was like, maybe this is something that I can do. Because before then, I had never really thought about just, designing games is something that like me, Connie, was capable of doing. And so the idea for Apiary came just a little bit after that. It was early 2019. We were talking about worker placement games and the idea that, you have this kind of static worker pool over the course of the game and that you add one worker, maybe you add two workers. But normally after you play a game a few times, there's sort of an accepted meta of how many workers you should add over the course of the game. And so it's not as interesting as I think I would like it to be. I mean, you think getting a worker should be this really consequential decision, but in a lot of games, it's just very rote. I mean, you do it up until round three and then you stop doing it after that. And so I sort of had this idea of like, well, what if workers aged and died? I think we had just played Village, which, has a little bit of that in it. And at the same time, I was looking into beekeeping. I was starting to become a beekeeper and the two things just kind of synergized instantly as like, oh my gosh, if you have honeybees, that's how workers function in a hive. They're always coming in and out. And so it really was kind of a eureka moment, and so that kind of concept, the idea of workers aging and dying was there from the very, very first version of Apiary and stuck around until we moved the game to space, at which point they aged and hibernated instead.
Yeah. Something I like about Apiary is, as you said, sometimes in worker placement, you take some actions at the beginning and then you take some actions at the end. Like you're not always motivated to take them all throughout the game. And I think what Apiary does great is when you have 4 strength workers, which is the max strength that they can get to, you get bonuses on each of the actions. So it's kind of rewarding to take all the actions at some points when you're at strength 4, and at the end you can go ahead and if you have like 3-4 workers and you want to hibernate them, and you can go to 3 different actions, and that doesn't happen too much because you end up just choosing the best early actions and then the best late actions, and it kind of discourages like some part of the board becomes ignored at some point.
Yeah, and it's definitely not a game where you're going to go to all of the spaces evenly throughout the game. But I will say, though, that especially with some of the strength 4 bonuses, for instance, you tend to do more exploration at the beginning of the game. I mean, that's your primary way to collect resources. But as you develop your hive and as you build out other, some of your other player powers and things like that, you have a lot less need to go back to that spot until all of a sudden you get a 4. And then there are some of the planets that give you a special bonus for going there with a strength 4 worker. And some of them are really good.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden you'll find yourself sort of going back to a part of the board that maybe you thought you had kind of moved past just because all of a sudden you get that bonus. And as I said, some of them are significant. And I do think a really big, important part of Apiary is figuring out how and where to use your strength 4 workers. I mean, that's, going to be probably your primary point sources through either you can tuck some seed cards that give you scoring, endgame scoring, you can buy some carvings. You can take the bonuses on some of the planets, and then you can also flip over your faction tile, which often gives endgame scoring or extra bonuses. And so kind of figuring out how to use and sequence those strength 4s is, I think, really key to the game.
Yeah, sometimes they're hard choices. If you have just 1-4 strength worker, it's like all of them are good. Like all the options can be good, circumstantially maybe, but they can all be good at a certain point. So you said you became a beekeeper. Could you just tell me a little bit about that? I'm just kind of curious. How do you do that? What's your favorite thing about beekeeping?
Yeah, absolutely. So I live in the middle of Washington, D.C. We have bees in our backyard, which is a very small backyard. But D.C. makes it really, really easy. And we just have 2 hives back there. And so they're really largely pretty self-sufficient. I mean, you check on them every couple weeks during the summer and then maybe once a month or something like that in the winter. Kind of peek in the top every now and again. I think my favorite part about it, though, is just kind of, this is going to sound a little bit weird, but going, watching them go through their daily life. Sometimes if it's a nice summer day, you can just kind of watch them coming and going, and then you can actually watch them doing their little waggle dances. And so, you know, a bee will come back and it's, they have these little like, pollen sacks basically that hold pollen, you know, and you can see when the bees fly in that they are filled with, you know, they're carrying as much pollen as they can, and they'll land and they'll do their little dance. And then you can watch the other bees sort of fly off in the same direction. And it's really, really fascinating to watch because I don't really know how the bees learn. I mean, they don't live very long, but it's sort of incredible that they've have these relatively sophisticated communication processes.
Okay. I mean, I can see it being like soothing, just watching them go around their daily lives. That sounds cool.
It is. Well, it is. And the believe it or not, the noise associated with like a happy calm beehive is actually a little bit soothing as well, because it's sort of a very like low level buzzing. And the more you get used to them, the more you can kind of tell when the hive is agitated versus when they're, you know, when all is well.
Okay. So like, do you wear like the suits and everything?
Yes. So I have a kind of, it's like a half suit basically. So it protects me from the waist up. And then I just figure if I get stung on my legs, it is what it is. Because usually when you get stung, it's on your, you know, hands, because that's what are in the hives. I will say though, I had sort of a silly moment a few weeks ago, and I think most beekeepers go through this at some point. So I was putting some food in the hive. So a lot of beehives, you feed them a little bit of supplemental food in the winter. And so I was going in to put the food in there, and I was like, all right, I'm just going in the top. I'm barely going into the hive at all. I'm not going to wear any of my protective gear. It's late at night. They're all going to be calm. It was a mistake. They went on the attack. They chased me all the way back into my house, and I ended up with 5 or 6 stings. So I was a little I mean, I think every beekeeper's probably goes through that sooner or later, where you get too blasé about it, and then you get punished for it, and then you go back to being like, "All right, I'm gonna be responsible and actually, you know, put my bee gear on."
I think that happens with everything. Like, you're like, "Oh, I already know how to handle this, whatever hobby it is you have," and then you get taught a lesson, I guess, in a way.
Well, and probably 19 times out of 20, what I did would have been just fine. And you know, the 20th time, the hive was probably agitated. It was robbing season, so basically bees steal honey from other hives, and so they might have just fended off some kind of an attack, and so they were probably a little bit agitated already, and then all of a sudden this big creature is coming in and disrupting them. So
yeah.
And again, I learned my lesson.
Well, it probably will happen at some point again when you start trusting
in
again.
Another few years. Yep.
I'm really enjoying apiary. I've played it, I don't know, like 4 or 5 times in the past week or so since I got it. I've enjoyed the solo, but then again, it's still a solo mode. I'm not big into those. I like to laugh and have fun with my friends. But I mean, I think I've heard great things from like those people who really enjoy the solo. And I think it's a good solo. I've played some that I haven't enjoyed as much. But I wanted to ask, like, what did the first version of apiary look like? Were there much changes? And if there were, like, what were the biggest one from your first draft to the thing that I have set up on my table right now?
Yeah. So a couple of the early versions, and keep in mind, this was my first design. So I flailed a little bit. I mean, it wasn't the most focused process in the world, because I was sort of learning as I was going. Some of the early versions had a map. So it looked a little bit like a Marco Polo or a Coimbra or something like that. So your bees were kind of traveling around the map. I don't know why it didn't make a lot of sense, but that was just a mechanism that I was familiar with. So I put it in the game. The other thing that was really weird, and at the time I knew it was weird, but I couldn't figure out what to do about it. They were actually bringing fields back. So this was before the game was space themed. So they were just honeybees. And for some reason, they were bringing different types of fields back. So you had a little field tableau that you were building. So you were building out a hive, and then you were also building out kind of a grid of fields in front of you. And that was never very coherent. I mean, it didn't make any sense as to why they were doing that at all. One other thing that I'll flag too, and I think was sort of a good lesson in design, it did a good job making the game what it is that, you know, I started out with D6s, with 6-sided workers, and they would go from a 1 all the way up to a 6. And it took probably 5 or 6 versions of the game to realize that was just too slow. You know, an awful lot of, I mean, we were just talking about White Castle that has 9 turns, but an awful lot of Euro games have somewhere between 15 and 25 turns, given the length. I mean, it's really not that many turns. I mean, you know, I think the most that you're usually going to see is about 30, something like that. And so if you're thinking, okay, 18, 20 turns, something like that, and you're waiting for a bee to level all the way from 1 to 6, it's just too slow. I mean, if you're really trying to get that in inflow and outflow of workers, it's too many turns. And so I started using D4s fairly early on in the process. And that's, I think, when I really started to make a lot of progress with the game.
Yeah, I can see these sixes taking too long because the current version doesn't take too long. I was like worried. I'm like, I think this is going to take a while. It starts slow, but then it just quickly ramps up. But then it's like, oh, okay, we're about to finish. Nice.
That's the one thing that gives me a little bit of pause about the game. And it's unfortunately, it's a function of the game end condition. You know, so the game ends when the hibernation cone is full, which depends on how many workers you've hibernated. The problem, though, is that's not really a linear process. So you'll be halfway or even more through the game and you haven't hibernated a single worker. And so it is the first time or two you play can be a little bit misleading. You know, you think the game is going to be much longer than it is. And then all of a sudden you look around the table and you realize everyone has 3 strength 4 workers and that hibernation comb is going to fill up in 4 more turns. And so unfortunately, I wish there was a better way to telegraph that because it's just not a linear endgame condition. And I think just about everyone who plays it is a little bit caught off guard in their first play.
I really liked that. Like I wasn't sure like when we were going to finish. So I wasn't able to count the points or like, oh, I'm way ahead or something. I've won by 1 point like twice. Which is something I like. It sucks when you're the person who lost for 1 point, but it's really good because it's like very tied up to the end. Like when you're counting, it's like, you won. But then it's like, nope, I won you just by 1 point. That it feels really good.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of different ways to get points too. So I think you can really come at it from a couple of different angles. You know, we talked about those end game carving tiles. Like I've had some games. So I was actually just played a game with David, my partner, the other day. We were trying to test something specific, but I think I ended with 3 or 4 carvings, which is about the most I've ever had. And I've had some other games where I end with 0. And so I think there's a lot of different paths to victory.
Yeah. So you said this was your first design?
Yes.
Okay. You know, because sometimes designers are like, I have designed games before, but this is the one I ended up submitting for publishing and the one that made it. But it's much more impressive now, I have to say.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, I think I sort of stumbled into it a little bit. And I'll also say too, that, and I've mentioned this on another podcast and stuff, but the DC board game design community is really excellent. So I've kind of fell in with some very experienced designers very early on. And I think they did a really good job of helping me find the core and find the fun more quickly than it would have ever happened, you know, had I been just kind of on my own.
Yeah. So, you know, you told me some changes that occurred throughout the game development. What was the best change for you, you think?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, definitely switching from D6s to D4s or to 4-sided workers was a big one. The other one I think that we added actually fairly late in the process is the idea that every single space has a really nice bonus for going there with a strength 4. And I think that really, that was a fairly late change. It was fairly late in the development where we added that. One of the things that we added toward the end was you can upgrade the factions. So before the factions were just single-sided. And when we went back and said, okay, how can we make each of these spaces special with a strength 4? That was one of the things that we added was basically the flip side and the upgraded side of the factions. And I think that making those strength 4 workers feel extra special was one of the best changes for the game.
Okay, I did not play the previous version, but I think the 4 strength bonus for every action is definitely a winner.
Yep, absolutely. I agree 100%.
Yeah, because otherwise you wouldn't be as motivated to go to spaces that you haven't been in a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, when did you start designing Apiary?
Yeah, so I started in early 2019, and then I worked on it really, really pretty intensely for about a year, right up until COVID happened and the lockdowns happened. And then I kind of took a year or so off from working on it. We kept waiting for things to open up, and I've never been huge into the digital. I play games on Board Game Arena, but I've never particularly enjoyed digital games. I really like the in-person interactions. And I haven't done a lot of playtesting online. And so I kind of just set the game aside for a year and then picked it up again in, you know, mid-2021.
Okay. And when did you end up submitting it to Stonemaier?
Yeah, so I went to Stonemaier's design day, which I think was September 2021, okay. And then got to talking with Jamie after that event. And so I think we signed it in something like November of 2021. So then it took, obviously, you know, close to 2 years from that point. And a lot of that was development, and then some of it was just the rest of the production process, which can obviously take quite some time.
Yeah. So I have like 2 questions kind of relating to that time.
Go for it. Yeah, absolutely.
What was the hardest part of that process?
Yeah, so there were two parts I think that I found really difficult. And one was the part before I went to Stonemaier Design Day and was sort of thinking, okay, I think this game is basically done. At least this game is as done as I know how to make it. What now? You know, I'm not really a networker. And so I really kind of lucked into things with Stonemaier, but sort of staring down the barrel of having to start pitching my game was just something that was incredibly, incredibly intimidating to me. So that was one part that was really, really hard. And I think there are more resources now, or maybe I'm just more aware of them than there were a couple of years ago for figuring out how to pitch games. You know, it's a whole sort of special second skill set. And the other part of it that I found really challenging was, you know, I think we did 6 waves of blind playtesting through Stonemaier. And so this was, you know, I submitted the game, Jamie and I went back and forth, I did a couple of versions, some local playtesting, and then we would, you know, send it out for a wave of blind playtesting, you know, do some more tweaks, send it out again, and so on and so forth. And I think by about wave maybe 5, you know, you're just starting to burn out on it a little bit because it's, you've just been working on it again and again and again and again and again. And I think the last couple of waves were a little bit of a challenge to get through and to really put as much time and mental energy into it as the game deserves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you get exhausted, like working on the same thing, I guess, over and over has got to be challenging at the very least.
Well, and I think it's also, it can be a little bit tough too, because, you know, you make a change and 80% of the playtesters are like, oh, this is great. And then the other 20% is like, this made us miserable. And it's like, oh no. And that's, you know, no game is going to be for every gamer.
Yeah.
But it's so hard when you're getting that playtest feedback and you're trying to figure out like, okay, what if this is game specific? What tweaks can I make to make it a little bit better for somebody? And then what is just, maybe that person is never going to like the game. And so trying to kind of filter through that feedback, I think, is a real skill.
Yeah. Like, yeah, maybe they're never going to like it. So trying to cater to that specific feedback, maybe it doesn't work out in the end.
Right. Right. And I think that's something that Jamie Stegmaier is really, really, really good at. You know, every single time we got a wave of feedback back, you know, he would do kind of a first cut of it and say, okay, I think these are the really impactful, important things. These are the other pieces of feedback that came back that maybe are less relevant. You know, maybe they were playing a rule wrong, or maybe this game isn't quite for them. And then he would sort of send me all of the files, and then I would do kind of my own review, and then we would touch base on it. And I think he was very, very good at that. I mean, he's obviously has a lot of experience with this stuff, and allowed us to, or allowed me maybe, but, you know, to kind of cut through some of that, and I think really take into account the right feedback, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's gotta be tough. Did you ever get like a comment where you were like, I don't know, like that got you down or something like that?
Oh, all the time. And I would say too that continues to present day. And I think that's something that is very much a learning experience for me. And it's going to be very much an area of growth as a game designer. You know, if I stick around in this field, is it, you know, even with the published game, which I think, you know, has been doing very well, people seem to really like it in general, but there are some people who hate it, you know, and there's, I stopped doing it, but for a while I was reading some of the ratings on Board Game Geek. Don't do that. That's a bad idea. Just don't do it. Because, you know, and I think there's sort of two types of comments. And one type of comment is, this game didn't really click with me. It wasn't fun. I like, you know, APR is relatively high variance. And so somebody who wants a very, very, very low variance game, it's not going to be the best fit for them. That's fine. The ones that really sting, though, are the ones that are basically like, this designer is incompetent. How are they so stupid? I saw one comment like, why is this Connie person out there designing games? And that's where it starts getting a little bit personal. And so I think it's one of these, you do have to have a thick skin, absolutely, because that's going to be, you know, again, people will say all kinds of things on the internet.
Yeah, I think staying away might be a good idea. Or like, you know, sometimes if you want to go into it, like, it's fine, but trying not to take it personal, it's got to be hard, because you're like exposed to a lot of people, and like Stonemaier, particularly, games get exposed to a lot of people. So that's going to make it harder. Like, there's going to be more people than that don't like it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a fine line too, because, you know, I want to become a better designer. Like, if there are things about the design, and I think I've learned things since designing Apiary, you know, that there are going to be certain things that are going to strike people the wrong way and make for an unfun game experience. And I mean, you're in game design because you want to bring people joy, not frustration. And so I think getting some of that feedback, figuring out how to, again, like the playtester feedback, filter the right feedback and learn from it and grow from it is really valuable, while also not getting down by some of the, you know, some of the other comments that you see and that you read.
I mean, as long as they're constructive, even if they didn't enjoy the game, I think that's the ones you should focus on.
Yep, absolutely, 100%. And I think it's really that constructiveness that, you know, because there are a lot of constructive criticisms of there out there about Apiary, and I would certainly agree with some of them. And even some of the ones that I don't necessarily agree with, I certainly see where they're coming from and would maybe take that into account in the future.
Yeah.
But then, as you said, with Stonemaier in particular, there are going to be some detractors who probably not particularly productive or constructive.
Yeah, ignore the haters, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's probably good advice for everyone, right?
Yeah. So, you know, this was a long process on your own, and then there was a long process with Stonemaier Games. So what did a day in Connie Vogelmann's life look like when you were working on Apiary? I mean, the days that you were actually working on it, because you have a day job, so I guess not every day was dedicated to that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of days, though, to be honest with you. And this is where I do think you need a lot of dedication. And I've sort of said this before, but I think, you know, you don't design games for, you know, for the money or for the notoriety or anything like that. I mean, you design games because you love designing games. Because, I mean, I don't know how many days I would, you know, you go to work in the morning, I usually get back, you know, 6:30, 6:45, something like that. I work for the government, so I have a pretty regular schedule, which is nice. You know, take a little dinner break, and then start working on Apiary at 8 p.m. and then wrap up at, you know, 11:30, 12, 1 in the morning, and then you go to work and you do it all over again. And I, for better or for worse, I think it's definitely both, I tend to get very, very focused. So once I get started, I have a really hard time stopping, which does kind of build up over time because you realize that every night's a little bit of a late night and you still have to get up on time in the morning. And just sort of shout out too to the game designers who have kids. I don't know how they do it, to be perfectly honest. I know a couple of wonderful designers and they have three kids, and I don't know how they do it. But kind of kudos to anyone who can figure out that kind of balance.
Yeah, I mean, it like sounds like designing takes a lot of time, and then if you have a day job and then if you have kids, that's a lot to juggle.
Well, because I think the other part about game design too is, in theory, you want to be educated about the field as well. I mean, you want to stay up to date to be playing games as well. I mean, how are you going to be a good designer if you don't follow the current trends and play a lot of games and things like that? And so you just sort of start running out of hours in the day. And one thing I really like doing is just listening to a lot of podcasts and consuming a lot of board game media. So like whenever I'm commuting or, you know, doing chores or whatever, I always sort of have a podcast on in the background. And I think that's a really good way to kind of stay up to date on things as well.
Yeah, because playing games takes a lot of time and there's not enough hours in the day to play every game.
No, I mean, and that sort of goes back to the question about, you know, do you want a day job? And it's like, well, oh God, I'd love to just sit around and play games all day. That would be wonderful. I mean, that would be living the dream, right?
Yeah. So you were saying that you can like really get into the zone. Do you have like a ritual or anything you do to get into the zone, into the mindset for designing?
Really, the only hazard is I just tend to be a night person. So the later it gets, the more in the zone I get. And then you're sort of watching the clock tick later and later and later and go, oh my God, I have to go to bed. And then, which is one more thing. And oh my God, I have to go to bed. And one more thing. No, I will admit I don't have much by way of rituals. It's just as soon as I start opening up the files, I'm kind of off to the races.
Okay. I did notice that you're a night person. So am I, to be fair. And so, you know, through this whole production process and development process, I guess, how involved were you with the decisions of like, how's this going to look, or how are going to materials we're going to use, or how are the minis going to look? Or did you just give them the game and that's it?
No, I mean, one of the absolutely wonderful things about working with Stonemaier is how involved I was in the process. That, you know, I mean, we talked about all of the blind play testing. And so everything that, you know, had to do with the rules of the game, you know, the tiles and the components and everything in the game. I mean, I certainly had a say in. I mean, obviously the publisher has the final say, but it was always a discussion. It was always a back and forth. My opinions were always given, you know, quite a bit of weight. And there was a lot of back and forth on some of the more important components too. So the workers in particular, Jamie and I had You know, he had them basically 3D modeled, and then we kind of talked through different configurations, like which orientation should the numbers be? You know, did they basically, should they be parallel to the workers or perpendicular to the workers and the direction they faced? You know, how should the workers turn and things like that? And so for the bigger components, I was certainly included or consulted on them. I certainly wasn't included on some of the, you know, the details. And I didn't have much, I really didn't have any kind of say in the art at all. I mean, that was done very, very separately. But in terms of like the game and the gameplay, it was a very, very collaborative process throughout.
Okay. Nice. Yeah, because I know some publishers are just like, the game is ours, we're going to do what we're going to do, and you'll see it in a year or so.
Well, and I've heard a lot of horror stories about that too. I mean, games coming back with really, really significant flaws. You know, if a critical rule was changed, and it really upsets kind of the balance of the game. And so I think for me, having this much involvement was a really wonderful experience. You know, I'm very, very happy to, like, it was wonderful getting to work with Jamie and learn from him and everything. But also being able to always have that back and forth and be consulted was really, really excellent. I don't think I would want to be one of those designers who basically passes off the game and then it comes out two years later and who knows what it's going to look like. I mean, that's a little bit terrifying because it's still your name on the box, even if it's drastically different than the last time you saw it.
Yeah, and it's like, it could change so much that maybe you're not that behind the game or something like that, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we talked to the designer of this new game, Barcelona, and he designs Euros, and he designed a Euro which was like kind of like a computer kind of thing, but when the publisher got it, they changed it, and now it's called Windmill, I think, and it's like about flowers and like tulips on Holland and on the Netherlands. So it's changed so drastically. I was like, oh, okay, that can happen.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard, I mean, anecdotally, I think that happens a lot, which can be really unfortunate, especially if you're a designer that is just getting started, to have your kind of game change like that.
Yeah. So. I mean, thankfully, I think he wasn't that married to that theme, so I think that was good. Mm-hmm. So you said you had kind of like a hard time, or you were very like anxious about pitching to the publisher. Do you have any tips now that you're a published designer about how to pitch to a publisher?
Yeah, well, so the one thing I will say right off the bat is there's a YouTuber named Adam in Wales. I believe his name is Adam Porter, and he has a YouTube channel. And he's just been doing a 100 tips and tricks about game design and game publishing. And that is absolutely the first place to go. And a lot of his tips and tricks have to do specifically with pitching with publishers. And a couple of really good points that he's made is, you know, publishers are people. And so a lot of them aren't as hard to find as you might think. I mean, they have contact information on their websites. They also, a lot of them go to some of these big cons too. And it's obviously expensive in both time and money to get there. But if you can, you know, reach out. And a lot of times, you know, I'll see things on game design forums and it's 2 days before the con and they're like, how do I get a meeting? And it's like, well, you've missed your window of opportunity for this con. You know, start a couple months ahead of time. Do your research. Find publishers who are publishing games that are like whatever game you have designed. And try to set up pitch meetings. And I think it's really just reach out to 10 publishers and maybe two or three of them will listen to you, you know, will give you a pitch meeting. I mean, it's, and so I think a lot of it's just, you just have to kind of make yourself do it. And also there's a lot of good resources out there too. Cardboard Edison, for instance, I think for about $5 a month, something like that, gives you an access to a lot of different game publisher contact information and kind of a little summary and whether or not they're accepting, you know, open solicitations for games. And so I think there's some of the resources like that can be a really, really big help as well.
Yeah, that sounds really helpful. Yeah. Now that, you know, you've designed your first game and published your first game, do you have maybe a game that you learned a lot about game design? Like, what game would you recommend to someone who wants to learn about board game design? Maybe one that, I don't know if it's the same that you learned and you would recommend a different one, or if it's just the same game that you'd recommend?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer. I was thinking about this question, and I really don't have a very good answer to that one at all. my one piece of advice, and this is very trite, is to just play as many games as you can and get yourself out of your comfort zone too. You know, don't just always play the same type of games. Like, you know, go play your Ameritrash game, play your filler, play your party game, play your Euro games, play your war games. And I could do a better job at that, of course, too. I think we all could. But I think just experiencing a variety of different mechanisms, a variety of different styles is really valuable. And the other thing that I would say with that too is, ever since I started designing games, I almost started enjoying playing games more. Because if I'll be playing a game and I'm not particularly enjoying it, all of a sudden I'll start thinking, all right, what is it about this game that is or isn't hitting with me? What's the part of it that I really like? What's the part of it that I really don't like? And I guess one game that I will actually flag, because I think it's kind of a very, very interesting lesson, is like PAX Premier. I played that game for the first time maybe 6 months ago, and it was a little bit mind-blowing to me. And I played through the whole game, and I had the hardest time wrapping my brain around it. But it's an absolutely brilliant design. And I think that's kind of a good lesson about innovation in games, that the more, you know, everyone always says that they want innovation in games. The more innovative your games are, the harder they are for other people to understand. And I think that's a really good trade-off. And that's something that I think every game designer should be aware of, you know, that you want, in theory, some kind of a unique twist or a unique idea or a unique combination of mechanisms or something. But just remember that if it's a fine line of how far it gets kind of too far out there. And I also think, too, that, you know, obviously, if you're Vital Lacerda or you're Cole Worley or somebody like that, a lot of your fans will give you that respect, and they will play your game 5 times, and they will kind of get over that initial barrier. And then all of a sudden they will experience this wonderful game that you've created. If you're a new designer, though, you might not get that many chances. And so I think it can be hard, especially for new designers coming in at a kind of a heavier level of complexity, because you might only get one chance by the publisher, one chance by players, and so on and so forth. So I think that's just something to kind of keep in the back of your mind.
Yeah. Like if you change the, conventions, I guess, too much, everyone's gonna be so thrown off. Like, yeah, it's gonna be hard.
Yeah, yeah. And that doesn't mean that it's not a game worth making. It doesn't mean that it's something that you shouldn't pursue. I mean, you absolutely should if that's you know, where your passion is. But it's just something to keep in mind that it is going to be a little bit difficult. And I think be aware of that complexity, especially if you have something very innovative and very new and very different. You may have to strip out the complexity from a lot of other places of that game because of the mental burden that new mechanism or that new component will require.
Yeah, they probably have like a different target audience trying to go super different. So the next one doesn't have to do as much, but I've always felt curious. I feel like board game design, not necessarily the player community, but the board game design, it's like a great, still like a great stronghold for men. It's been getting better, and there's more women designers every day, I think. But did you ever feel as a player or as a designer that just for being a woman, you had less space, let's call it, in the community?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think especially in my early days as a player, I absolutely did. I mean, you know, when I was first going to some of those meetups in Washington, D.C., I mean, some of the guys were wonderful and they are some of my best friends today. But some of them were assumed that because of my gender, I was less capable or less competent or less knowledgeable. And I mean, I had experiences where I brought a game and taught a game and had guys talk down to me the whole time of like why my strategy was insufficient, even if I would then, you know, ultimately go on to win the game. And so that definitely didn't feel great. And so I do kind of encourage folks to, if you have a game group and if you're part of a game group, especially if it's some kind of a public group, like a meetup group, and everyone looks exactly the same, maybe think about that a little bit. You know, are there women, are there minorities, you know, coming to your game night? Do they come back? And if they don't come back, are there reasons for that? I will say though, that as a designer, I have found the board game design community to just be incredibly welcoming. You know, I started going to some of these unpub events, after the pandemic, and have found the designers there to all be incredibly welcoming. And there were a number of mostly men, because those are the majority of the folks there, who really went out of their way to make sure to welcome new players. And so I think, or new designers. And so I think the design community is probably a step ahead of the rest of the community, at least in terms of attitude. There are still obviously fewer non-white designers, non-white male designers, than I think we would all like. But I do think that the industry is going in a good direction.
Yeah, I mean, most places have been like dominated by men, and then that's been changing. And I think women designers are like getting more notoriety out there, I guess, which I find great. I stumbled onto this, Elizabeth Hargrave has on her webpage like this very complete, like, continent by continent, like, list of women designers. And I was baffled. I was like, okay, that's a lot of work. but I think, like, that's a huge step in the right direction. And
absolutely. And I think her list actually goes beyond just women too. I mean, I think it includes basically anyone who identifies as a non-white male, essentially.
Yeah, basically.
And so it's a wonderful resource. And I'll say too, I mean, Elizabeth is, you know, she's local. She's very much been a mentor to me, but she, I think, is doing kind of a Herculean task of getting more visibility in games and game design and game publishing. And I, you know, she's just doing a lot of really, really good work on that front.
Yeah. you mentioned, like, you took a game, and this is not my story, of course. These things don't happen to me just because I'm a man, mainly. But Anna, my partner here in the podcast, she told me, like, at a board game meetup, she took a game, her game, and a guy was trying to explain it to her. And I was like, I mean, how could you not get that? If, like, it's their game, they probably have a good understanding of it, of how to play it, you know?
Well, and yeah, as I said, I've had that experience before. I mean, less lately than I did, you know, a few years ago, certainly. But unfortunately, that's still something that's a little bit present. So, you know, as I said, I think we're getting better, but I do think all of us, you know, myself included, can really sort of speak up if that's happening too. Because I think if something like that happens, the other players at the table kind of tend to, you know, look the other way or ignore it. And I do think calling out that behavior, you know, you don't need to be nasty about it, but just saying, like, hey, this is her game, like, let's let her teach it. Let's assume that she knows what she's doing. Maybe, you know, might be kind of a subtle way to, you know, to help a little bit and to make that space more welcoming.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of gatekeeping in every hobby, I guess.
Well, of course. I don't remember which of the online, this might have been, oh gosh, I don't even remember which video game it was, but I remember seeing a quote that was something like, I'm just going to use League of Legends, but like the only thing that League of Legends players hate more than people who don't play is people who play but play less than they do. And I think there's that kind of prevalence in a lot of fields. I mean, not just games, but sort of in everything.
Yeah. Are there any women designers you'd recommend? I've been trying to do my due diligence and, like, get more games by women, but I'd love to know more.
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, first of all, it's worth flagging that there's a few, you know, male-female design duos out there that are really excellent. I mean, Inca and Marcus Brand have been doing game design and great Euros for forever. You know, Isra C and Shay S that just did White Castle and Red Cathedral as well. And Min and Elwin, who did Lost Ruins of Arnak, are excellent. In terms of solo female designers, I mean, we obviously just talked about Elizabeth Hargrave. I mean, all of her games are absolutely excellent. She's one of the few designers that's on my Insta-buy list. Whenever she publishes a game, I always just buy it. Tori Brown, I think, stormed onto the scene with Votes for Women earlier this year. Yeah. And, you know, Amabel Holland is doing just absolutely amazing, like, mind-boggling games. I think a lot of her games are absolutely fantastic, and they're just completely out there. I mean, they're almost pushing the boundaries of what even is a game. And one other name that I'll throw out there too is Talia Rosen. She has a game signed with Fort Circle that should be coming out in a year or so. And I think she's going to be a real name to be kind of reckoned with. I've played a couple of her games now, and they're absolutely fantastic. So they just need to wait a little longer to hit the scene. So it's sort of a few names to throw out there.
Hey, there's a couple I wasn't aware of. So that's good. So I'll do my due diligence and get started on those.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate it. And I do just sort of challenge folks to, at some point, just take a look at your shelf. And I think it will be a little bit stark when you realize sort of how few female designer names are on your shelf right now. But again, it's getting better. So I'm really sort of optimistic about the future. But I do appreciate the discussion and kind of getting the chance to talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, I studied literature, and I realized at some point, like, most of my library, like, bookshelves are filled with men, so I started, like, switching towards trying to get more women. And I realized the same with board games recently. And I just want to, I think getting the conversation going is at least something.
Oh, absolutely. 100%.
Yeah, Elizabeth Hargrave, yeah, she's great. Wingspan was one of the games that got me into board gaming, like, serious board gaming, I guess, like, more seriously.
Yeah.
And I try to like get all of her games. I actually just signed up for my first Kickstarter, which is her Undergrove. We'll see how that goes.
Undergrove is great. I really, really enjoy Undergrove. I've actually been I playtested it a few times with her, you know, in the past. But then also, it's on a alpha in Board Game Arena, and I've been playing it and realizing it's just a fantastic game.
Oh, right, because you live nearby and you have like board game designers meetups, I guess, playtesting and stuff.
As I said, we're very, very, very lucky in that regard.
Hey, nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to her because I really like Fungus as well. So it's like right up my alley.
Well, and I think expanding games into just cover different topics and different genres is really nice too. I mean, there's so many people who will play a game about birds or about mushrooms and trees who won't play a war game or won't play a medieval European city building game. And so the more inclusive the board game themes can be, I think the more inclusive the hobby can be as well.
Yeah, and it gets people who aren't into board games but are into Fungus and are like, oh, let's play this game. And maybe, like, I've known some people, like a lot of people with Wingspan especially, because they're like into bird watching and then they became like board gamers because of that.
Yes, I think the bird watching community is really special.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very large and very passionate community, and it's fascinating what kind of overlap there's been and how many birders have now been brought into the field.
Yeah. Is there anything you can tell us? I mean, I know there's a Roland move, like a different, like a very nice Roland move for how it sounds. But what's your next game? What are you working on? Are you working on maybe expansions for APRE? Are you going to be working with Stonemaier? Anything as much as you can give us? I know these things.
So I think Jamie has mentioned that I am working with Stonemaier, or I'm continuing to work with Stonemaier. Unfortunately, though, I really can't talk about any of it. You know, I think that there will be another game that should be announced fairly soon. I mean, within the next couple of months, certainly. And I think that will be sort of interesting, but that's about all that I can say.
Okay, well, that is something. There is something being worked on with them, so that's, you know. I know they're super secretive with their games. They just kind of drop out of nowhere, and you're like, oh, okay, I guess there's another game for my wish list now.
I mean, it's an interesting model. I mean, it's kind of nice. It's a little bit refreshing to not have, you know, I mean, I know Kickstarter does a lot of good for an awful lot of publishers, and it really makes the cash flow work. But it's really, really kind of nice to not have that with Stonemaier. So.
Yeah, I just got into my first Kickstarter, as I said, with Undergrove. And you know, when I buy off of Amazon or on my local stores, I'm always like, I'm sit by the door like, okay, when is it coming? When is it coming? So Kickstarter is hard. And I think Stonemaier kind of neutralizes that, like long wait periods. I don't build my hype up for like over a year and then it dies off when the game is actually here. So I think that is really good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And yeah, just the last one before I let you go, just because we
absolutely.
The idea here, we like to talk about design, and because we have in Colombia here, like people who are interested in designing, and we've got some great games coming out as of late, and the industry and the scene is growing. And what advice would you give to a beginner? Maybe something you wish someone had told you before you got into game design.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have kind of two main pieces of advice. And one is make a prototype. Even if you don't have it fully fleshed out, even if you only have the first third of the game figured out, even if you only have a few core mechanisms, because the instant you get it to the table, it's not going to play out the way that it does in your head. It just doesn't. I mean, maybe some people are capable of doing that. I've heard some of the really experienced designers are better at that. But I think especially when you're starting out, you know, getting it to that table and taking those first few turns will be really really important. Second, this is one of my pet peeves. Don't spend a lot of time on your prototypes. I mean, at this point in time, I throw out or recycle just about 100% of my printed components between each and every prototype until I get very, very late in the process. And so the quicker and faster you can prototype, the easier it will be to make changes. You know, when I first started APRE, I was laminating all of my pieces. And then, of course, you don't want to make changes because you just spent hours and hours and hours prototyping. I think, and I guess the last piece too is if you're getting into it, especially if you're doing some kind of a big deck game with a lot of cards or something like that, there's a lot of programs, some of which are free, that can really help. So there's a program called Nandeck that I use for a lot of my components, and I really wish I had started using it sooner. because it's basically you make all your cards in an Excel spreadsheet. You do some very incredibly minimal coding to import icons and things like that. And then you basically click a button and it will populate all of your components. And I spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours on Apiary doing them, you know, manually moving little icons around on the screen. And it was a real waste of time. And so for me, at least, Nandek was a little bit of a learning curve, but I strongly recommend it to anyone who's going to be making a lot of components.
Hey, yeah. How hard is it? Because
so I came in with no coding background at all. I mean, zero. And it probably took me a full day on a weekend to put together a template. And then once I have the template together, it's good to go. And you can change some pretty easy parameters. There's a YouTuber called Ludo Lodge, LudoLodge, who has some really great tutorial videos and just step by step. I mean, he's like, all right, add this line. So then I paused the video and I added the line and then I hit play again and, you know, made it through that way.
Hey.
And I guess one last piece of advice too is just don't get discouraged. You know, I think the first, you know, you have an idea in your mind and you think it's going to be this highly playable game and like, it won't be, it almost certainly won't be. I heard an interview with Steve Finn, who did Biblios and has a game publishing company, and he does fairly lightweight games. And he said it takes him an average of 35 drafts to get a game together. And it's probably going to be more than that for a heavier Euro, and it's going to be even more than that if it's your first game. So I think for me, that really helped keep it in mind that like you're not going to have a playable game on version 1 or version 10 or version 15. And so for me, that really kind of helped me not get discouraged. Just be like, all right, it's version 1. Let's move on to version 2. And then maybe by version 15 or 20, you'll have something that plays. And then by version 30, you'll have something that's pretty good. And so it takes a lot of time.
It's a waiting kind of patience game, I guess. That's a really good one.
Absolutely.
Okay. So thank you, Connie, for your time. I'm sorry we went a little bit over.
Oh, that's okay. No, thanks so much, Oz. Wonderful to get to chat. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you for Apiary. And well, I hope your games start hitting the shelves and they keep coming. I really love the Apiary. So I'm super pumped for the next Connie Vogelmann game.
Awesome. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for coming. And maybe I'll see you when your next game gets out.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.